I'm an alcoholic. My name's Nancy Kunkel. And as soon as God gets done shaking me, I think I might be all right. Before I forget, I want to thank Mike and the committee for asking me to come here, and I want to thank Paula and Joy for keeping in touch with me over the last few months. And I think Mike gave me two hosts because he knew I was going to run, so he put one on either side of me. God, what a privilege and what an honor, and I think I'm living proof that fear and faith can coexist, because I am beyond petrified, and I have absolute faith that at 5 o'clock I'm going to be all right. And you know, I only know how to do one thing up here, and that's to share with you what I was like when I was drinking, how I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what my life is like today as a direct result of being an active participant in my own sobriety. So that's what I'm going to do. Like I said, my name is Nancy Kunkel. I am an alcoholic. My home group is the Elk Ridge Monday Night Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and oddly enough, we meet in Elk Ridge, Maryland on Monday nights. First Monday of every month, we are a step meeting. So if you want to be a member of the Step of the Month Club, come on down every Monday, and we'll help you get through all 12. My sobriety date is July 4th, 1988. And, man, what a miracle that day was. Stop shaking, Nancy. I've never done this before, so I am very scared. Number 7 out of 8 kids. I forgot to tell you, I do have a sponsor, and I use her and abuse her on a regular basis. Hi, Anne-Marie. I'm number 7 out of 8 kids. I grew up in a very wealthy family out in Colorado, 36-room house, 3-acre yard. Money was not an object for me growing up. I came from one of those families that when you made out your list to Santa Claus, it didn't matter if you had one thing or 10 things on your list. You got it. It didn't matter. And you know, that's what, the way I grew up. And I'm here to tell you that money can't buy happiness for this alcoholic. I know that because I lived that. You know, even being number 7 out of 8 kids, it was like I was all alone out there in the world. And when I was 10 years old, my parents went away to Hawaii for a couple of weeks. And that was a mistake. They actually made the plans to go, and then they actually left. And they left the oldest kids in charge, and they were like 18 and 19 at the time. And living where we lived on this 3-acre whatever, we didn't really get touched by anybody, so the oldest kids had a party that lasted for a couple of weeks. And somewhere in that 2-week time frame when my parents were gone, the oldest kids at one of the parties thought it'd be kind of cute to see the youngest kids get drunk. And I had my first taste of alcohol. And what I found from that experience was that alcohol could kill feelings, and alcohol could make me forget, because I blacked out and I passed out the very first time I ever drank. And I can't tell you how much I drank, can't tell you how long I drank. All I know is I started drinking, forgot, and woke up, and I have no idea how long after I started drinking that happened. And for this alcoholic, that was real key for me in my life at that point. There was a lot of things going on in my life, and I didn't understand why they were happening. And from that day until the day I found the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I chased that. You know, I never drank to be like you. I never drank to fit in with your crowd. I didn't drink because I thought you thought it was cool. I didn't drink to make friends. I drank for two reasons: to kill my feelings and just to forget, get as far away from Nancy as I can possibly get, because, see, I can't stand being here right now, and you don't understand, and this is the only thing that's going to help me. And so I drank like that. It was real, real easy for me to get booze growing up. My parents kept a very well-stocked bar, and they were blaming the 18, 19, 20-year-old brother who was getting locked up in jail every weekend for stealing the booze. They weren't looking at the 10, 11, 12-year-old little girl in her Catholic uniform for stealing the booze. And I'd steal booze as much as a regular basis as I could, and I'd sit at my room, and I'd drink alone until I passed out, and I wouldn't have to worry about what was going to happen to Nancy that night. And that's the way I drank, and I drank all through middle school, and I drank all through high school. When I was 17 years old, I found out I was pregnant and hadn't a clue how it had happened. It was somewhere in a blackout somewhere. And I don't know, the guy that, I call him a gentleman now, the gentleman that got me pregnant confessed to what had happened, and I gave him two choices: marry me or die. He was in the military, and my father was an officer in the military. He only had two choices: marry me or die. So I got a hold of my birth certificate, and I forged it, and we went to another state one weekend and cut school, and I eloped. So I was 17, living in my home, pregnant, married, and I came back that weekend. You know, parents thought I was at the girlfriend's house, and she was covering for me. And I proceeded to live in my house like nothing had happened until I turned 18. When I turned 18 years old, I packed all my worldly possessions in a couple of garbage bags, and I told my parents that I had been married for several months, and in a few more months, I was about to give birth to a child. And they were not real happy with Nancy, to say the least. And I went off to live a house, picket fence, 2.5 kids, happily ever after. You know, and that's what I thought marriage was about. I grew up in the era of the Brady Bunch and Father Knows Best, the Partridge Family, and that's what I thought marriage was going to be like, Father Knows Best, you know. Now, granted, my family was nothing like that. You know, I always, I related to Cindy Brady. I always wanted to be Cindy Brady, and that's what I wanted my family to be like, and we were more like the Addams Family. We were nothing like the Brady Bunch, and I don't know, what I've come to find out is that that a marriage certificate doesn't bring a house, a picket fence, and 2.5 kids and happily ever after. You know, that marriage, all he did was drink and fish, and all I did was drink and cry. You know, I was 18 years old, I gave birth to a little girl, and I was a kid trying to raise a kid, and I didn't have a clue. I was scared. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to make her cry. I mean, the whole time I was pregnant, I thought, you know, I'm going to be the best mom that there is. This kid's not going to want for nothing. I'm going to love her like my parents never loved me. I'm going to give her all the attention that I never got. She's not going to have to be afraid like I was afraid. She's not going to have to be scared like I was scared. She's not going to hurt the way I hurt. And bottom line, I was incapable of providing those things for myself. I don't know how on God's earth I thought I was going to transmit that to another human being. But I was a kid raising a kid, and I didn't have a clue. You know, that marriage lasted for about a year and a half, and we parted and went our separate ways, and for whatever reason, a judge saw fit to give me custody of that little girl. And I kept that little girl until June 16, 1985. And from the time that we divorced, I moved from Virginia to Maryland to Texas and back again, and I was looking for it, and I didn't know what it was. I just knew it wasn't here, and it wasn't now, and it wasn't working, so maybe over there it'll be different. You know, but maybe over there it'll be even better, and maybe over there will be even better, and it was never any better, and it was never any different. It was just the same old thing again, you know. And in the beginning, I truly believe in my heart of hearts that I love that child, and in the end, I absolutely loathed her. And that's not because I didn't love her. It's because she got in the way of my drinking. She was a burden, you know, and I had drugged that poor little kid to Texas and back again, and I'd pawn her off on anybody. It didn't matter. You know, if I met you and you said you were willing to watch her, there she was. A few days later, I'd show back up, you know, and I really feel sorry. Well, I feel bad that I did that to her because she saw the worst of my drinking. She had to live through the brunt of it, you know, and I'd ended up in New Jersey, and I was living in this apartment, and I didn't have any heat, no electricity, no hot water. I knew how to get my welfare check, and I knew how to get drunk. I didn't know how to do anything else. You know, I didn't know how to do anything else. And you know, the power company had come and turn off my power a bunch of times, and instead of, like, paying a bill or making payment arrangements or anything like that, I went and got bolt cutters, and I cut the lock off the little meter until finally they came and removed all the piping away from the wall. And on June 16th, 1985, I truly believe in my heart of hearts that I showed that child the only true act of love I was to show her at that time in my life. And that was to make a phone call to her grandparents and ask her if they could please come take her. And it wasn't the first time I had called them, but it was to be the last. And they said yes, that they would come and take her from me. And they said on one condition. I said, well, what's that? And they said that if you sign away all your parental rights to that child. And bottle of booze, child, bottle of booze. Yeah, I signed away all my parental rights for my child. And from that day until the day I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I lived in the streets of Philadelphia and New Jersey and Atlantic City, and that's where I lived. And you can use your imagination. I did absolutely whatever I had to do on a daily basis to survive, and that's all I did was survive, you know, from one day to the next. And I shared all that stuff with my sponsor and my fifth step, and I don't need to share it here at a podium. You know, but use your imagination. If you think it, I probably did it. And, you know, what happened was I'd conned this man after I went and I started hanging on the streets of Philadelphia and New Jersey. I'd conned this man into buying me a car because I told him if I got a car, I could get a job. And if I got a job, I could get an apartment. And if I got an apartment, then I could get my kid back. And he was very gullible, and I was very manipulative, and he put his name on the line for the credit, not mine. And so I lived about the last 6 months of my drinking in a 1979 MGB Midget. And I know a lot of people live in trucks and vans. Try living in an MGB Midget. And you know, then at the time, about the last year of my drinking, my typical day was to come to wherever I had come to from the night before, wherever I had passed out, and just go scamming for my next drink or my next whatever. And I'd go by the Goodwill, and I'd grab a couple of garbage bags or bags or boxes or whatever I saw by there, and I'd throw them into my car. And if I had enough money for a hotel room, I'd go to a hotel. If not, I'd go to a laundromat. And I'd sift through the clothes, and I'd find something new to wear. And that's just how I was living, you know. And I sit there, and I think about that now. And I have a 9-year-old daughter, and I watch her. And she has these little dreams. And I listen to her little dreams about what she wants to be when she grows up. And I can tell you that this alcoholic never dreamed when she was a 9-year-old girl asleep in dirt and doing anything she could to survive on a daily basis and digging through the Goodwill. I never dreamt that. I never in my wild imagination dreamed that I would end up where I was. And I got there as a direct result of my alcoholism. And I didn't know that. See, alcohol was the thing that was getting me to survive on a daily basis. Because, see, you don't understand. You don't know what it's like to live inside of me. The shame, the guilt, the horror. You don't understand. And alcohol was the only thing that was keeping me going. You know, I was driving this car down the street one day, and I didn't do things like get insurance or get legal tags, or I stole all that stuff off of other cars, you know. And I got pulled over one day, and I highly recommend that if you're going to steal somebody's license plate, you make sure they don't belong to a police officer. And that just happened to be my luck. And I got pulled over, and I hadn't made a car payment because, see, that was all going to be I didn't know how to do that kind of stuff, you know. I had no concept for, like, taking care of Nancy and doing normal things that I do today. And so they towed my car away, and I was left standing on the side of the road, 85 pounds, dripping wet, with a t-shirt and a blue jeans, and that was all my worldly possessions. And that's all I had. And I don't know, I guess I did what every good alcoholic does, is I called my mom, and I asked my mom for help. And of course she said yes. Of course she said yes. And she wired me the money to come back to live with her. And the guy got the car out of hock, and he put me on the Jersey Turnpike, and he told me he never wanted to see my face again as long as I lived. And I showed up on my mom's doorstep in Columbia, Maryland, and you don't know how grateful I am to that woman today. She told me that I could live in her home if I was willing to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had a brother who was sober at 3 years at the time, and I didn't know that. And evidently my mother knew that I had a problem with drinking. I didn't. And I'm standing here before you today because my mother had a desire for me to stop drinking. Not me. I didn't have any at all. And it's hard to talk about my mom. So I detoxed on my mom's couch for a couple of weeks, and then I was brought to my first AA meeting in August of 1987. And I told you I didn't get sober until July of 1988. And I was brought to my first AA meeting. I thought this was great, and this was fine, and you guys are laughing and joking, and how dare you? How dare you laugh at those people? Don't you understand how much pain I'm in? How dare you laugh? And I didn't understand. I didn't understand at all. I knew that there was something different in the meetings because my mom would make me go to meetings, and I found this really cool place in Columbia where they had meetings at 6 o'clock in the morning, at 10 in the morning, at noon, at 6:30 in the evening, at 8:30 in the evening, and on the weekends they even had midnight meetings. So my mom would drop me off there because, of course, I'm still unemployable. My mom would drop me off there, and I would find people who were not serious about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my mom couldn't figure out how she could drop me off there, and I'd come home drunk. So after about 4 months of living with my mom, she kicked me out on the street and told me that the condition was that I'd be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, or I wasn't able to live under her roof. And I called this old boyfriend of mine up in New Jersey and told him how cruel and evil my mom was being to me, and she was kicking me out on the street, and could he come save me? And of course he said yes. And so he showed up, and we started living in the finer establishments along Route 1, like the Pendel Motel and lovely places like that. I don't know, we were drinking one day. It was a Tuesday, and he said, "Do you want to get married?" I said, "Why not?" So we took a cab in our Jack Daniels and went up to the Howard County Courthouse and got married in February of 1988. And that marriage lasted until July of 1988. And the whole time I'm still going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. What I couldn't figure out was how could you not drink? I didn't understand that. I didn't understand how you people could survive a 24-hour period without something in you, because I can't stand what's going on inside my head. I can't live with the shame, and I can't live with the guilt. And if you knew who and what I'd become as a direct result of my drinking, you wouldn't want me sitting next to you in the meetings. And I was full of shame, and I was full of guilt. And if you knew that I gave away a child, oh, my God, my family had disowned me, and I knew you would, too. And I was scared. And I'd go and I'd sit in meetings and I'd hear people say, oh, it's the first drink to get you drunk. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'd go sit in my little hotel room and play shots by myself. And I'd keep a little tick sheet and I'd mark down how many drinks it was. And somewhere along the line I'd pass out and I'd wake up and I'd see, like, you know, 15 marks on the sheet. And I'd come back and I'd say, I didn't get drunk until after the 15th drink. And I just didn't get it. And then a member of Alcoholics Anonymous pointed out to me the doctor's opinion in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he explained to me the mental obsession, you know, and the physical compulsion, that it wasn't when we passed out, it's when we mentally think, and all we can do is think about that drink till we have no other choice but to physically pick it up. And once I put that one in me, I have absolutely no clue. And I didn't understand that until he explained that to me. What was different about July 4th, 1988, as opposed to every day in the previous 11 months? The only thing that I can tell you that was different was that I asked God to help me not drink that day. You know, I had gone through 12 years of Catholic school. I went to religion class Monday through Friday. I went to church on Saturday, and I sung in the choir on Sunday. And I could teach you everything you needed to know about God because it had been shoved down my throat for 12 years. And see, God didn't work for me because God is why I'm here now. You know, and that's what I thought. I thought God did all those things to me. I had absolutely no clue that God gave me free will and that those were my choices, not God's choices. God was just there carrying me through, making sure I didn't die until I got here today. You know, I didn't understand that then. And, you know, I was sitting, there was a big 4th of July party going on and everybody around me is drinking and, you know, I'm sitting on the cooler beer and I'm just repeating over and over in my head, God, please don't let me drink. God, please don't let me drink. God, please, I'm begging you, don't let me drink. And for whatever reason, I made it throughout that whole day without a drink and I was absolutely amazed. I was absolutely amazed. I could not tell you when the last time was I'd gone a 24-hour period without drinking. I couldn't remember it. And so when I got up the next day, I asked God the same thing. And you know, I walked away from that marriage to get sober because it wasn't a marriage. It was a drunken Tuesday and something to do is what it was. And you know, I'd been hanging around these people in Alcoholics Anonymous that bowled and played softball. And the woman that was standing up here as the voice opened up her heart and her home. She had 9 months sober. And she said, come live with me. Get out of that mess. And I'm standing here today because she helped me get sober, you know, and I truly believe that. I don't know if I could have done it any other way. I don't know, you know, but she opened up her heart and her home and she let me come live with her. And she was going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every single night, and I was right on the back of her motorcycle going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every single night, you know, and everywhere we went for my first year of sobriety, it was Kelly and Nancy. Everywhere I went, you know, we were like glue. And you know, we got involved in the softball league and we got involved in the bowling league, and I hate softball and I can't stand to bowl. But you know, it gave me something to do. It gave me something to do. It occupied my hours with something other than thinking about drinking. You know, it put me and surrounded me with other members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then when I was 3 months sober, we were coming down here to this convention. And I didn't know anything about a convention. Kelly's like, you got $50? I'm like, yeah, I think I can scrape together $50. She's like, fine, you're going. We came and we parked on somebody's floor here at the convention. And she was secretarying a meeting, and she stood me behind a coffee and soda bar and said, get into action. Stay sober. And so that's what I did. I spent the weekend behind a coffee and soda bar coming in here to meetings, and I didn't know what was going on. I didn't have a clue. All I knew was I was with Kelly, and I was guaranteed I was going to be sober that weekend. And I was around a bunch of other drunks that were staying sober, too. And somewhere throughout that weekend, you know, I wasn't here for any other reason but to get sober and to try and stay sober that weekend. I had 3 months at the time. And I don't know, I think it was like Saturday night or something. Some guy was working behind a coffee and soda bar with me. And he was cute. God's will for me. And And, you know, I used to say that I met this guy that weekend, and we started dating. And I didn't know, I didn't understand what anonymity was, and I didn't understand what anonymous was. And, you know, I shared in meetings and shared with my sponsor. I met God's Will for Me and Honey Wonderful, and I called him everything but his name in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know why it worked, but I can tell you that it worked. And me and that guy got married 6 years into sobriety. We dated for 3 years. We're engaged for 3 years. And we'll be together 11 years this weekend is our 11 years together. And you know, the good thing about that relationship was is that he was real active in Alcoholics Anonymous. He had a sponsor and he had a home group, and I believe he was the GSR of his home group at the time. And he was always going to area committee meetings, and he was always going to area assemblies, and he was on convention committee meetings. He was always doing something. So if I wasn't with Kelly, then after that I was with him. And I was following him around like a puppy in heat, you know. But the good thing was is that he was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single night, and so was Kelly. You know, and I was drugged to meetings every single night, and he was involved in the convention. So then I got involved in the convention committee, and I think the next year I worked on the workshop committee or something like that. And I don't know, it just worked. We did everything backwards. You know, first we got a car together, then we had a kid together, and then we bought a house together and got married. Did it all backwards, but you know. Today, you know, it used to be a joke back then that he was God's will for me today, and to the depths of my soul, I believe that today. He is absolutely God's will for me, and I'm grateful that he was given to me in early sobriety and such a power of example, you know, to show me how he was active. And I don't know, so me and him started dating, and I don't know, I thought, well, heck, he's got 5 years, I've got 3 months, I'm set. He's got a sponsor. I don't need one of those. He's got a home group. I don't need one of those. He's working the steps. I don't need to do that. Because, see, all I have to do is bake him cookies, give him flowers, keep him happy in bed, and Nancy's going to be fine. Thank you very much. And that's what I honestly believed, and that's how I was living. I wasn't doing nothing but following Kelly and Steve to meetings and baking him cookies and giving him flowers. It used to be a big joke. He's a construction worker, and I used to send flowers to his job sites. He loved it. You know, and that's what I really thought was going to keep me sober, because, see, I don't need to do any of that other stuff. And when I'd see you guys at the bowling league and you asked me if I had a sponsor, I'd be like, yeah, because, see, I had one every other week. And as soon as they'd ask me to do something, I'd be like, well, you know, I was in this meeting the other night and I met this lady and we really clicked. And I think that she's going to work out better for a sponsor for me. So I did the sponsor hop for my first year of sobriety, not willing to make a commitment to anybody. And 9 months into this relationship, I was miserable. I was as miserable as I was when I was out there drinking, you know. And I tried to commit suicide a couple times in my life, and I got to a point where I wanted to do it again. And if I would have had a guarantee from the man upstairs, if I had put a gun to my head and pulled the trigger, I would have done it. I would have done it, because I could not survive with what was going on inside of me. It was more the guilt and the shame and everything else. And there was nothing to stuff any of those feelings anymore. And I definitely wasn't doing anything in Alcoholics Anonymous but showing up at meetings, and that was it. So he sat me down and he told me, he goes, you know, Nancy, I love you. And there's absolutely nothing in this world that's going to change my feelings for you. But you need to either go get sober, you need to go get drunk. You do whatever it is you need to do, but I'm going to be right here waiting for you when you get done. You know, and I hope you get done and we can be back together again. And I'm so grateful that he did that for me. You know, because I went to a meeting that night and I thought about what he had said, and he was right. He was right. He was absolutely right. I wasn't doing anything, and nothing was changing in Nancy. It was just getting worse, and all these feelings were boiling up, and I don't know how to handle them. You know, and I'm scared that I'm going to drink. And so I went to a meeting that night, and there was a woman chairing a meeting. It was called the Spiritual Awakening Meeting. Oddly enough, that meeting doesn't meet anymore. And she had two black eyes, and she was chairing a meeting. And I'm sitting there, and this is what I'm thinking. I was so sick. And I'm thinking, that's what I need. I need some tough woman who's going to beat the padiddly out of me if I don't do what she says, because that's how I thought she got her black eyes. She was sponsoring women that weren't listening to her, and she'd beat them up. And so I don't know how much I heard out of the meeting. I just knew that that I had to do something. And so I went up to her after the meeting, and I said, do you have time in your life for me? I didn't say, would you be my sponsor? I didn't say, would you work the steps? I simply said, do you have time in your life for me? And she said, of course. And we went out to the trunk of her car, and she got out a big book, and she handed me, she did a written first step, and she handed me a first step, and she told me to go home and do it. And what she had me do was she had me take out Webster's Dictionary and define every single word in a first step. For me, that was good. Now, I don't make the women that I sponsor do that today. But for me at that time, it was good because it got me active and it got me doing something about my sobriety. You know, and when I started working the first step, I had absolutely no problem whatsoever admitting that I was powerless over alcohol. I had been sober for about 9 months now, and I could see the unmanageability in my life 9 months ago, and I could see it clear as day to day, you know, how unmanageable my life was with or without booze, you know, and so I didn't have an issue with the first step, you know, and I came to understand that that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous could help me stay sober. You know, that there was no way on this earth I could do it by myself. You know, so we did the first step together. And when we got to the second step, I had a real problem with the second step. My father is a psychiatrist, and he runs mental institutions for a living. And I grew up for 18 years of my life watching people in mental institutions, and that's what I equated insanity with. I didn't equate insanity with how I was living. And then I heard people in the rooms talk about insanity was doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, and I didn't understand that either. Because, see, every time I picked up a drink, I expected oblivion, and that's exactly what I got, and that's what I wanted. I wanted nothing less than that. And I didn't understand that because I expected nothing else. And my sponsor, I don't know, she just told me not to worry about the insanity part. And so while we're working on the second step, I was horseback riding and I clotheslined a tree and I ended up in a hospital with a fractured sternum. And I was a little over 9 months sober at the time, and I'm sitting there screaming at the doctors, telling them they can't give me anything because you don't understand, I'm an alcoholic, and if you give me something, I'm going to end up drinking again. And I was just scared to death. I didn't know at that time in my life that it was okay to take medication prescribed by a doctor. Because, see, for me, if they say take one every 4 hours, I'm going to take four every hour, you know, because if one is good, four is grand. And so I'm laying there in a hospital bed, and I'm not letting them give me anything. And I was in the hospital for about a week, and you know, I was a little over 9 months sober, and my phone rang off the hook. I was ready to throw that sucker through the wall, and I didn't know who you guys were that were calling me. But you know, it absolutely amazed me. Not a single family member of mine called me. People in Alcoholics Anonymous I never even met called me. People got off the beltway, came to Harrah County General Hospital, sat down and read the big book to me for 5 minutes. They took time out of their life for Nancy. Nobody had ever, ever, ever cared about Nancy. And I sat there and I thought to myself, you know what, if the people in Alcoholics Anonymous can believe in me that much, maybe I can believe. You know, so I came to believe in the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor told me, don't worry about the insanity, more will be revealed, you know. And so I didn't, you know, I didn't know what the insanity was, but she kept me moving right on through the steps. And it was really funny, about this time, the girl that I was living with, her sister went and joined the Navy. And I thought, man, that's a good idea. I could get an education, have a job, be something. And so I went down to go sign up and join the Navy like Kathy did, because I just thought it was a great idea. So I went and I filled out all the paperwork and took all the little tests that I needed to take. And a couple weeks later, they called me back in and said, we'd like to talk to you. And I went down there and they said, you know, you could be anything that you want to be. You're a very intelligent woman. You got a small problem. So you got these 7 warrants out for your arrest in the state of New Jersey. And we can't take you in the Navy. And I'm sitting there going, oh, my God. And so I went to my sponsor, and I'm like, what am I going to do? They have these warrants out for my arrest in New Jersey. And she told me that I could do one of two things, that I could just pretend like I never heard it, and I could be driving down the road one day, speeding just a little bit too much, or maybe running that yellow light, and I could get pulled over, and they could take me back to New Jersey. Or I could suit up and show up and do the next right thing, which would be go and turn myself in. And just let the chips fall as they may. And she said, what a wonderful time to be working the third step in your life. You know, I didn't have to have any, you know, I think I'm kind of analytical by nature, but, you know, she made the third step real easy. You know, and she showed me how to do things like make a phone call and call an attorney. You know, I had been to court, I can't tell you how many times, for drunken whatever and doing all kinds of crazy things up in New Jersey while I was living on the streets those years. And the judge knew me by name. You know, and I remember standing there in the courtroom the last time I was arrested, and he told me that if he ever saw my face in here again, he was going to throw the book at me because he was sick of me. You know, and I would just show up in between a drunk, or drunk during a drunk. It didn't matter. I just showed up in court. you know. And I remember that standing in his courtroom one time, he had just dismissed a charge for something, walked out of his courtroom, got arrested, and got brought right back in the courtroom. And so he's throwing me in jail, telling me what my bail is, and I'm asking him if I can borrow money so I can bail myself out. And I was sick. You know, I didn't know what else to do, and I didn't have any living skills. And so I did what my sponsor told me to do. You know, I borrowed a dress from somebody because I didn't have any money for a dress. And I got a nice shirt from someone, and I had my sponsor show me how to put on makeup and curl my hair because I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. I didn't know how to look like a lady, let alone act like a lady. And she told me, I was scared to death going up there because I knew with all the charges against me that he was going to throw me in jail and I was going to be birthless for life. And that's just the way it was going to go. And my sponsor told me that it was a perfect way to work the third step. You suit up, you show up, you leave the results in God's hands, and just ask for God's will to be done through the judge. If God's will for you is to go to jail and be birthless for life, they've got meetings in jail. You go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you stay sober, and you carry the message. If God's will for you is to not go to jail, then you come back to the state of Maryland, and you stay sober, and you carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I'm really glad to tell you that when I went up there, they didn't throw me in jail. You know, I had to go to the bathroom in a cup for a couple of years and got a really hefty fine, and they took away all my driving privileges in New Jersey and asked me not to come back. You know, and I don't come back to New Jersey. It's that simple. But you know, I was really grateful, and I was really scared. And I was a year sober when I was standing there before that judge, you know. And he was absolutely amazed at what he saw standing before him, because he had seen me several times in his courtroom. And there he saw what looked like to be a lady. You know, she was dressed real nice. She had on heels. She had on nylons. You know, I had an attorney. You know, and he was amazed at what you guys had done for me in just one short year. And he really cut me a break, you know, and I was really grateful. You know, and when I got back to Maryland, that was in August, and in the next month I found out I was pregnant. And I'll tell you what, being pregnant was not on my top 10 things to do in my second year of sobriety. You know, I had a tremendous amount of shame and guilt for what I had done to that first child, and I didn't understand how I could be pregnant again. I was doing everything I could not to be pregnant, and it just happened. And so I went to my sponsor, and I'm like, what am I going to do? And she's like, well, the decision is yours. You know, I'll support you in whatever you decide. And so I ended up moving in with God's will for me. And shortly after I moved in with him, I found out that I had some conditions in my pregnancy that put me on bed rest for 7 months. And I had a doctor's note to go to one AA meeting a week. That's all I could do. And my sponsor told me that I had plenty of time on my hands, that now might be a really good time for me to write my fourth step. I took every one of those days of that 7 months to write my fourth step. And I believe God in his infinite wisdom knew that I needed to be pregnant at that time in order for me to get out all that stuff, all that shame, all that guilt, all that ick about Nancy. And shortly after I gave birth to another little girl who's wandering around here somewhere, I did my fifth step with my sponsor. And what one of the greatest gifts I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I highly recommend this to all the women that I sponsor, is after I got done 9 hours of reading what I had written those past 7 months, my sponsor had me burn my fourth step. And I didn't understand it at the time, but as those pages were turning into ashes and I was stamping them out, I realized for the first time in my life that I no longer had to be the girl that I'd written about in those pages. I didn't have to look like her. I didn't have to act like her. I didn't have to own her guilt anymore. I could be whoever I wanted to be. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a choice. They gave me a gift, and I didn't know that until then. What an awesome gift, you know, man. So, you know, we moved on to the sixth step, you know, after I got done that. And I really complicated the sixth step to death, you know. I went and wrote down a list of my character defects, and I went to Webster's Dictionary again, and I defined all my character defects. And then I went back to Webster's Dictionary, and I defined the exact opposite of my 1,001 character defects. And I thought, okay, today we're going to work on anger. And that's how I thought you got rid of your character defects, is that you picked them one at a time, and you got rid of them. Totally missed the part about God and the whole thing. You know, And so I'd wake up, and today's going to be the day that we're going to work on anger. And I'm sitting there in a meeting with Steve, and there's 100 people in the room, and there's one girl sitting in the far left-hand corner in the back. He hasn't even seen her, and he's sitting in the very front row. 5 minutes into the meeting, him and I are no longer together. I'm homeless again. He's married to her. They have 3 kids, a nice car. But I'm working on anger, and all this jealousy and envy and, you know, self-loathing's going off in my head, and I'm not understanding anything about the 6 and 7 step. And it really took me a long time to understand what those steps were about. And what I've come to understand is that as I'm trying to work on my character defects, one of them was stealing. I was working in this job, and I was working 11 at night to 7 in the morning. And I was making some money, not a ton of money, but I was making some money. And I had enough money in my pocket to buy a pack of cigarettes, and I'd walk into that store at night, and I knew I'd run out of cigarettes before the night was over, so I could choose to go buy them now or wait till everybody's gone and steal them later. Well, I'd wait till everybody was gone, and I'd steal them later, and then I'd still have the money in my pocket for the next pack I was going to need. And I'd be like, you know, this isn't honest living. Alcoholics Anonymous is trying to teach me how to live honestly. And so my sponsor helped me. She said, you know, Nancy, every night when you go in there, you just pray to ask God to help you not steal tonight. You know, and there may be a point where you're backed up against the wall and you can't stand the pain and guilt long enough that you're going to ask God to remove that character defect from you and you're not going to be a thief anymore. I'd go weeks at a time stealing, and I'd go a couple of days without stealing. And then I'd go a couple of days stealing and weeks without stealing. And it was a slow process for me, you know, that it was constantly asking God to help me with certain areas of my life for me to be rid of them, you know, and a lot of those things that the pain had to be great enough till I was humble enough to say, all right, God, I give up. You can have this, you know, and it's been a process for me. It's going from, like, those really, really ugly old habits and replacing them with some new and better habits and putting some principles in my life. And that's just how, for me, the 6 and 7 step has worked. And it's continuing, you know. I still sometimes have Steve married to some other woman and having 3 kids and a car, and I'm out living in dirt again. And when I get that kind of stuff, I just ask God to help me not be like that today, and I keep it really simple, you know, and I have absolute faith that God's going to carry me through, and I don't have to act out on that and, you know, go off on him for a half hour saying, I saw you looking at her. I know you were looking at her, you know, and doing stuff like that. I don't do that today. And you know, when I got to my 8-step list, you know, a lot of people say that they save their 4-step for their 8-step list, but my sponsor had me burn mine, and I'll tell you what, I had absolutely no problem at all making my 8-step list without that 4-step. And it was really amazing that several people that were on my 8-step list never even appeared anywhere in my 4-step, and I found that amazing. Because I had heard that you got your 8-step list from your 4-step, and I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? I burnt mine. I knew. I knew exactly who I needed to make amends to. And so I made my list, and without guidance of my sponsor, I went out in the world to go start making amends to people. And I guess I'd been sober about a year and a half at the time, and there was like 4 or 5 people who were members of Alcoholics Anonymous that I had on my 8-step list, and it's because I just couldn't stand them. Didn't like the way they talked. They had never said anything to me, never done anything to me. I just didn't like them. I didn't like the way I heard them talk in meetings. I thought they were nasty and mean and judgmental and how dare you, so you're on my 8-step list. And I didn't have a clue. So I remember I was at this Wednesday night meeting, and one of these people just happened to be there who was on this list, and he happened to be my husband's sponsor. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm listening to the meeting, and it happens to be on the 9th step, and so I'm standing outside after the meeting, and of course he comes over in all his arrogance, and how'd you like the meeting? I'm like, I thought it was great. And I said, so let me ask you a question. I'm like, how do you know when it's time to make amends to somebody? He's like, they'll just appear right before you. Big mistake. For about the next 15 minutes, I proceeded to tell him how much I hated him and how judgmental I thought he was and how arrogant and how dare he and da-da-da-da-da, going off on my litany, and he just stood there looking at me, you know, and after I was done, he's like, have you talked to your sponsor? And I was like, no, but you're on my list. And he put his arm around me and said, go talk to your sponsor. So I went and I talked to my sponsor, and I explained to her what had happened, and she, after she got off the floor laughing, She kindly told me that I could remove all those people from my list, that I didn't need to go make amends to people that I didn't like, that I just had to pray for patience and tolerance and quit judging other people, which was one of my character defects, had nothing to do with making amends to them, that that amends were to be made to the people that I'd been the tumbleweed in their life to. You know, people I'd run over like a bulldozer and didn't even bother to look back to see if I hurt them, see if they were okay. You know, I just bulldozed right through their life. And so I got to remove about 4 or 5 people from my list, which I was grateful for because it was long enough as it was. And, you know, right about this time I was sponsoring a woman, and she was going through a divorce. And so I was going to be a witness for her in her divorce and tell her how she was doing in AA and da-da-da-da-da. And I was real lucky with my financial amends. I didn't have to go looking for them because they came looking for me, because she had a really nifty lawyer who did a background check on me and got all kinds of financial stuff on me. So for about the next 5 years, I got my wages garnished to make all my... They just lined right up. And I was employed at the time, so 25% of my pay went to these people that I owed money to, so I could chalk those right off my list. You know, I didn't owe any money to the IRS, but I owed a lot of money for a lot of debts that I'd walked away from. You know, so I was real grateful. My financial amends got made for me. And with the other people on my list, of course you can guess my daughter was on there. And my family members were on there, and there was 9 of them to make amends to, you know, 8 kids, my mom and dad. And a bunch of other people, and so I started with what I thought were the easier amends, and you know, I know people find God in all walks of life and in every step that they work, and I'm here to tell you that I found a God that absolutely loves me through the process of the 9th step. You know, one of the things that my sponsor told me when I got done my 5th step was that I need to find a God that loves me, and that if I didn't, that one day I would get drunk. And I didn't understand what she meant. I did understand that I was scared to death of God. I did understand that I could become a nun and I wasn't going to be good enough for God. You know, I could understand that I thought I had broken every commandment. You know, who knows what I did in a blackout. And I was just scared. And as I started making amends, you know, mostly with my family members, I didn't know how they were going to react or what was going to happen. And you know, I'm here to tell you, I think it's real important. I hear over and over again in meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous that people get their family back and their mom and dad love them and their brothers and sisters, you know, just fall at their feet and think they're wonderful. And I'm here to report to you that that does not always happen. You know, and I think it's important for people to know that you can stay sober if you don't get your family back. I tried for about 4 years to shove my amends down my family's throat. And I didn't understand what I was doing wrong. And I'd go back to my sponsor and I'd be like, you know, they slammed the door in my face. They hung the phone up on me. They don't want to hear from me. They don't want to have anything to do with me. You know, and I didn't understand what I was doing wrong, especially with my mom. You know, I'd sit there and me and my mom were like oil and water. You know, I love my mother, but we just didn't get along. I don't know if I was so much like her. I don't know what it was, but you know, and I'd go over there and I'd sit down and I'd try to make amends to her. And what I found that I was doing in hindsight was I was bringing up all that pain. She'd say, Nancy, I don't want to hear it. And I'd be like, but Mom, you have to hear it. And I'd be telling her all the awful things that I had done to her. And she didn't want to hear it. And all I was doing was throwing daggers in her heart. And I didn't have a clue. And I was doing the same things to my brothers and my sisters. And I'd be like, but you don't understand. If I don't do this and you guys don't love me, I'm not a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd sit in meetings and I'd cry night after night because I'd hear you talk about how you got your family back. And I'm sitting here going, my family hates me. What am I doing wrong? You know, and I come to find out that if they don't want to hear it, they don't have to hear it. And I didn't know that. You know, that the best thing that I could do, and I heard it in this very room, when I was first getting sober, there was a lady speaking at this convention. And she talked about that she didn't know how to make amends to her mom. So what she would do is she would just show up and she'd be a kind and caring and loving daughter to her mother. And I thought, wow, what a novel idea. You know, expecting nothing, just show up and be a kind and caring and loving daughter. And somewhere in the process, she doesn't know when or where it happened, but she was a kind and caring, loving daughter to her mother. And so I started doing that with my mom. I would just show up and I wouldn't try to shove my amends down her throat anymore. I'd go over there and I'd cook her dinner, or I'd go over there and I'd clean, or I'd go over there and let her visit her granddaughter, or I'd invite her over to my house for Thanksgiving, or I'd invite her over to my house for Christmas. And my daughter, I'd just invite her over on Sunday to have tea, or I'd show up at her work, and even though I knew there was going to be an argument or something, I just kept doing those things. And you know, I'm here to report to you today that I know today, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that my mom loves me. And I didn't know that. Somewhere in the process, I became a kind and caring and loving daughter, and I didn't worry about shoving my amends down her throat anymore, and I didn't keep throwing those daggers in her heart. You know, and I stopped doing it to my family. I firmly believe today that in God's time, not Nancy's time, maybe my family will accept me back in their life, but I'm here to stand before you today to tell me today's not the day. You know, July 13th, 1997, my mom passed away. And I showed up at the hospital, and I was like, I didn't even get to say goodbye. You know, me and my husband had just bought our first home. I had my mom over the week before to see my home, you know, which was nice. She came over and she had tea. I never knew if my mom really, really loved me or she was really, really proud of me. I just never knew. So she died on a Sunday, and in her pocketbook, we found a safety deposit box key. And we went to the safety deposit box, and we opened it up, and there was a will. And in her will, my mom had named me as executor of her estate. And she had 8 kids to choose from. When I was a year sober, and all those legal problems were hanging over my head, I went and I asked my mom if I could move in with her, because I couldn't financially pay for the attorney and keep living where I was living and pay rent and do all that stuff. And on that day, my mom said, no, I don't trust you. 9 years later, a week after my 9th anniversary when she passed away, I found out that my mom was screaming that she loved me and how proud she was of me. You know, and I can tell you the last couple of years trying to deal with my other family members, and this has not been easy. You know, and I can stand here before you today and tell you that I have not done one thing in these past couple of years that I have to go back and make amends to any of them for. Through the entire process, to the best of my ability, I've handled it with dignity and grace. And I've been a kind and caring and loving sister regardless of what they say to me and regardless of what they do to me. You know, and they were not happy. My husband can attest to it. My family was not happy that they named Nancy as the executor. You know, but I've tried to do the right thing, and sometimes I often wonder if my mom did that to get back at me or she did that because she loves me. You know? But whatever, I'm trying to make my mom proud now, you know. And you know, when I got to the 10th step, I used to do a 4-step every year. My sponsor had me do one every spring. And I would use that to beat the living daylights out of myself. And look at how awful I am, and look at how terrible I am, and I'm still no good, and I'm ugly, and I'm this, and I'm that. And I have a sponsor today who absolutely loves me, who utilizes the 10th step, so I don't have to go back and beat myself to death with the 4th step anymore. You know, I've done several over my years of sobriety, and you know, every day, my 10th step is a list of questions that my sponsor has me ask myself. And I have the list sitting right beside my desk at my computer. And every morning I ask myself, how is my relationship with God? How am I doing as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, how am I doing as a wife? Am I being a good partner to my husband? Am I being a loving wife? How am I doing as a mother? How am I doing in all those areas of my life? How am I doing as an employer? How am I doing as an employee? You know, and that's my little 10-step checklist that I go through every day. You know, and at night when I put my head down on the pillow, I ask myself, you know, is there anywhere where I've been dishonest? You know, have I done anything to hurt anybody? Is there anybody I owe amends to? You know, and I get together on a weekly basis with my sponsor. Every Thursday night we have an 8 o'clock meeting. She lives in Massachusetts and I live in Maryland, and that's just the way it works. And talked to her last night so I could get out of tonight. But, you know, we go over those things that I may need to make amends to people for. And when I do, I go straight to them and I make amends. And sometimes I can't always talk to her, so I have to talk to somebody else and say, hey, this is how I handle the situation. You know, so I try and do my 10th step daily. With my 11th step, I'm still real afraid of a formalized prayer. For the life of me, I can't get myself to read all the prayers that are in the big book, the 3rd step, the 7th step prayer. The one that I do read is out of the 12 and 12, the St. Francis prayer. You know, and I read that one daily, and I read my 24-hour day book, and I just pray to God like I've seen others pray to God. You know, I say, hey, dude, I'm here. Help me out today. Let's go do this thing. You know, and I keep God in the forefront every single day in my life, you know. And I know that the things that I have in my life today are a direct result of God in my life, you know. And with the 12-step, sometimes I'm a little overzealous in the 12-step, and sometimes I'm not really good. You know, I'm very active in service work to Alcoholics Anonymous, very active. You know, I got involved in Maryland General Service when I was real early in sobriety, and I've remained involved in Maryland General Service, you know. You ever hear about an assembly or a committee meeting, if you show up, I'm there. You know, I'm at my home group, and I greet at my home group, as Paula told you, and I'm the coffee maker at my home group. You know, I'm very active in my sobriety. You know, I study the 12 traditions with my sponsor, and we've studied the 12 concepts. And I didn't understand what all that service work and what are concepts and what are traditions and what are those going to do in my life, and they don't mean anything. See, I've got the 12 steps. Thank you very much. And I've come to find out that those other, you know, two pieces of the triangle are crucial to this alcoholic sobriety. You know, through my service work in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to meet people all over from Washington, D.C. to Maine. I go to conferences, conventions, assemblies, service, everything. You know, it doesn't matter. And I've met people all along the way who have affected my sobriety in one way or another. And they're really close friends of mine today. You know, sometimes I think I'm a really stinky sponsor, and other times I don't. You know, I sponsor several women who are active, who are working the steps, who are a big part of my life, you know, who are a tremendous part of my life, and they keep me in the big book. You know, when I sponsor a woman, starting on step one, we open up the big book and we start from the very first page, you know, the contents, and we start reading until we get through page 164. You know, and then I tell them, now you go take another woman through it. Wherever it says that there's an action to take in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we take it. You know, and so I'm constantly going through the steps with them. And one thing I did want to tell you before I stop here is I told you earlier that I had given away this little girl. And I don't want to forget to tell you about her in my story because she's real important to me. I got back in contact with her again when I was about 4 years sober. I remember showing up one day when I was about a year sober. I found out that she was having her tonsils out, so I just appeared at the hospital. You know, great way to introduce yourself back into your child's life after about 4 or 5 years. Wasn't a real good thing to do. So it took me about another 3.5, 4 years after that to get back in contact with her. You know, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous really helped me through that because I didn't understand how to do that deal. And I firmly believe through my service work in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to be a mother. You know, by taking service commitments, you guys showed me how to be dependable. You showed me how to take a commitment and make a commitment and keep it. You know, so when I would talk to my daughter and I got in contact with her and I told her, well, I'll call you Friday at 9. I called her Friday at 9. And I didn't know how to do that any other way but through Alcoholics Anonymous because, see, when I said I'd be coffee maker at my home group, I showed up and I was coffee maker at my home group. You know, you taught me consistency and persistency. And my daughter lived about 3 hours away from me. And I'd see her about every other month. I'd make the journey. It was about, I'd say, into my 8th, maybe 9th year of sobriety before her father actually allowed me to take her out of the state of Virginia and come visit me in Maryland and spend a weekend with me. And that was through consistency and persistency. If I said I was going to show up at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, you better believe I was in that driveway at 9 o'clock Saturday morning. I wasn't 15 minutes away calling on the phone saying, I'll be right there, honey, sorry I'm late. I made sure I was there on time, as I stated. And I can tell you one of the worst feelings in the world was when I first saw her after about another 4 years, when I was about 4 years sober. I'd seen her once in the time I'd given her away to then. And I knocked on the door, and this little girl opened the door, and I didn't even know if she was really my daughter because I didn't know what she looked like. And that's not a good feeling, you know. But I kept that consistency and that persistency in her life. And so she started coming up on visits with me and Steve. I don't know, one day out of the blue, she was 15 years old, and she called me up on the phone, and she asked me if she could come live with me. You know, and I can tell you, every single time I went to go visit her, I wanted to take her away, and I wanted to bring her back home, and I wanted to make amends, and I wanted to show her what a wonderful mother that I was. And my sponsor would tell me, Nancy, in God's time, not your time. You have absolutely no right to rip that child away from the only home she's ever known. How selfish. And I believed her, you know, and I'm really grateful that I did, because that one day happened. And she came to live with me and my husband, and she lived with us for about a year and a half, and it wasn't easy. You know, she's out there writing her story right now. You know, we basically forced her to be sober when she came to my house, and she really didn't like our rules, and she was a teenager. You know, there was a lot of pain, and there was a lot of hurt, and there was a lot of guilt. And she was okay when it was the whole family together, but as soon as it was her and I alone, I would hear about how awful I was, what a terrible mother I was, how dare I, how could I. And those were not easy conversations to have because I didn't have an answer other than I was drunk, you know, and I'm sorry, and there's nothing I can do about it. And it was about a year before I really, you know, I thought I was gone with that guilt up until that point, and I had to face it head on. And I can tell you today that I don't own that guilt anymore. You know, me and my husband were at work one day, and he came home, and she was walking out the door, and we haven't seen her since. And she's called a couple of times, so I know she's alive and well. And I know that one day there's going to be a knock on my door, and I'm going to be a kind and caring and loving mother to that girl. You know, that's all I can do. You know, and I pray that God keeps her safe, and I hope that she knows that I love her. You know, I absolutely love her. You know, I have a husband today who is beyond my wildest imagination. I didn't deserve him. I didn't deserve him. I have a new daughter today in sobriety who, most of the time, is a wonderful kid. You know, she is, she's active in Alcoholics Anonymous. She shows up at our assemblies and our committee meetings, and she takes the lunch money, and she's an active member of Alitot. What can I tell you? She's a founding member of Alitot. And you know, we have our moments. And you know, today I know that there's a God that out there that loves me, absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt. I know he loves me. Pimples, PMS, and all. He loves me. And I didn't know that when I got sober. I believe today beyond a shadow of a doubt that I have a God that will keep me sober under any and all conditions, period. There is no gray area in that statement for me today. I've been an active participant in my own sobriety, and for that I've reaped the benefits. You know, I've gotten so many gifts in this program. Friends beyond my wildest imagination, you know, women friends. I didn't have that when I got sober. I have women in my life today that I care about and I love, and I would give my right arm. Give my right arm. You know, when my mom died, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't know who to call because I never fostered any relationships with any women. All I had worried about was a relationship with my husband. And I had the women that I sponsor, and those weren't the kinds of relationships. It wasn't a connection with a woman that I could just call up and cry. And I called this woman up, and I said, I want to work on being your friend. I don't know how to do that. Will you help me? I give my right arm for that friendship today, you know, and she was there for me. And, I can't say enough about Alcoholics Anonymous and what it's given me. And I'm not talking about a house, and I'm not talking about a car, and I'm not talking about a nice job. I'm talking about self-respect, dignity, pride. You know, I can look in the mirror pretty much on a daily basis, except when I'm PMSing and like what I see on the other side of the mirror. You know, I'm pretty happy with what I see. You know, most days I go through thinking that I'm not junk, but there are still days when I'm not good enough and I'm still less than. It's one of my worst character defects that I work on, you know, and I don't know. God's not done with me yet, you know, and I'm absolutely honored and privileged to be here. Never in my wildest imagination did I think I'd be standing up here, you know, never. And I'm just grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful to be sober, and thank you.